Today, in a momentous political week, we talk about what comes next for Brexit. And The Guardian's environment correspondent, Matthew Taylor, on what you can do to limit the impact of air pollution. Do you think the EU would like Brexit to go away?
I think, well, there's an awful lot of Brexit fatigue.
Are you suffering from Brexit fatigue?
Oh, I am.
We need you not to. I'm not suffering from Brexit fatigue. It was another last-minute dash over the channel for Theresa May to secure assurances that might persuade MPs to back her Brexit deal. It was also another late night for The Guardian's Daniel Boffey. He's been covering these negotiations for 2 years from Brussels. Sonia Soda has been writing about them from here in the UK.
I mean, it's just, it's hard to remember a time when there's been so much kind of uncertainty.
As the Prime Minister prepares to put her agreement to another meaningful vote, we examine what comes next. Deal, no deal, or a delay to Brexit. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, is this the week that decides Brexit? In the face of another potentially crushing defeat in Parliament, Theresa May knew that she had to get something more from EU negotiators. Last night, she headed to Strasbourg to meet European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. The Guardian's Brussels bureau chief, Daniel Boffey, also scrambled there from the Belgian capital, along with dozens of other journalists.
Hello.
Hi, Dan. It's Anoushka.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Where are you?
So I am in the European Parliament in Strasbourg, which is this ghastly building, round building, on the edge of the city. I am in a press conference room, which is just off the main press room, and it's a series of desks with reporters busily waiting, which is what reporters busily do quite a lot of. And we are hoping that Theresa May and Jean-Claude Juncker will arrive within the hour to tell us what they've agreed and what the fix is. We'll sort this deal out and get MPs to support it. Juncker and May are currently in the Winston Churchill building, of all buildings. And then they'll come over to this side of the Parliament to talk to us, is the plan.
And you've just headed over at speed from Brussels, so you weren't all expecting this to happen.
We didn't expect this, no. I mean, we expected possibly she'd turn up on Monday morning in Brussels if negotiations had gone well over the weekend. Negotiations didn't seem to have gone that well over the weekend. Something has changed today, that they need to have something to present to the Commons tomorrow, and they're going to dress up whatever they've got to try and persuade MPs to back the deal, at least reduce the numbers who rebel against the deal. So trying to get some of those down, maybe for them sort of prepare the way for a third meaningful vote at some point.
What are you hearing that they've got?
It'll be so the first part is a joint interpretive instrument, which is the legal add-on to withdrawal agreement. They will try and emphasise in this instrument that both sides believe it should be a temporary arrangement, that they'll both try and negotiate an alternative to that backstop as soon as possible. And they'll put a particular emphasis in trying to find a technological fix to the backstop. This is what the Brexiteers always saying is possible. But these are assurances. There's going to be one other bit is a sort of UK unilateral statement, which we assume will be emphasising again the UK's intention to get out of the backstop within a certain number of years. But again, it's unilateral. That's not UK-EU agreed. That's a unilateral statement. And then I think in the political declaration there'll be some tweaks about process, sort of suggesting that we'll be able to do things very quickly, move on to trade talks very quickly, as soon as this deal is ratified, as soon as the withdrawal agreement is ratified. But in itself, none of this will change the withdrawal agreement. None of this will reopen the withdrawal agreement, as Theresa May pledged. None of this will create a time limit on the backstop or a unilateral exit mechanism. These are the two big asks of the Prime Minister when she came to Brussels.
So you don't think that it's a substantial change, but do you think it is possible, with people now talking about Brexit being extended and with Labour swinging behind a second referendum, that the Brexiteers in the Conservative Party are essentially looking for a ladder to climb down, that they want to find a reason to back her deal.
Yeah, I mean, it might well be that they're looking for a ladder to climb down. So much uncertainty. Admit the Theresa May loses the votes, everything's in play. I mean, the survival of the government is in play. So yes, they might be looking for a ladder. I'm not at all convinced this ladder is strong enough. And they're going to try and dress it up. I'm sure the EU and UK side, they'll turn up and they'll try and dress it up as something it isn't really. If Jacob Rees-Mogg wants to be fooled, then you know, perhaps they'll be fooled. But I mean, it'll be pretty obvious pretty quickly that this is not what Theresa May came for.
MPs were clear that legal changes were needed to the backstop. Today we have secured legal changes. Now is the time to come together, to back this improved Brexit deal, and to deliver on the instruction of the British people.
Theresa May will hope that a last-minute agreement with the EU will be enough to win a critical vote in Parliament tonight. It follows months of tensions over her demands for Britain to be outside the single market and customs union.
What we will be doing is ensuring that we take back control of our money, of our borders and our laws as we leave the European Union.
But with a soft Irish border.
Indeed, you only have to speak to businesses near the border, as I did yesterday, to see that the notion of a hard border is almost inconceivable.
The original solution, the so-called backstop, resulted in her losing the first meaningful vote by a record majority of 230.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432.
Now, with some new assurances and the deadline for a no-deal Brexit looming ever closer, she will try again in another meaningful vote. She lost by a majority of 230, and in order to turn that around, she basically has to change 116 minds. Now, in that last vote, 115 Tories voted against her and 10 DUP. We know she's desperately trying to change the backstop, but is there anything else she can do to persuade them?
She's also sort of got a sort of more implicit strategy, which is making that side of her party feel like, well, it's her deal or no Brexit.
Sonia Soda has been writing about this for both The Guardian and The Observer.
And on that sort of strategy, I think she will start to win, even though there aren't going to be big changes on the backstop. I think she will start to win some of those MPs who voted against her deal on the Eurosceptic side of her party round, just not enough to see her deal through.
We should say if she wins, it would be extraordinary for Theresa May. And if that happened, then assuming the European Parliament ratify the deal, Brexit goes ahead as she has planned. More likely, as you say, she'd lose again. What would happen next?
If we'd been having this conversation 3 weeks ago, I'd have said, well, she leaves it another couple of weeks and she brings the deal before Parliament when it's real crunch time and we're about to crash out of the EU in 2 days. But there have been some really significant political developments in the last couple of weeks. So we've seen a small bunch of Labour and Conservative MPs actually leave their parties, partly over Brexit. And that really emboldened the softer Brexiteers in the Cabinet. So we saw three Cabinet ministers, Amber Rudd, David Gawk, Greg Clark, pen quite an extraordinary op-ed, actually, saying, if you don't offer us an extension, we will resign from the government to vote against no deal. So that's really forced Theresa May's hands. And that's why, if she loses a vote on Tuesday, we're expecting two votes to follow this week. The first will be offering Parliament the option, it's a non-binding vote, to take no deal off the table. But no deal is a default scenario. So the only way of taking no deal off the table is either for Parliament to tell the government to revoke Article 50, I mean, never going to happen, or for Parliament to tell the Prime Minister, you need to ask the EU for an extension. And so that's why we'll first of all have that non-binding vote, and then we're expecting the Prime Minister to have a vote in Parliament on extending Article 50. And I expect what will happen if the Prime Minister loses the vote on Tuesday, I expect the government position will shift to being in favour of asking for a three-month delay from the EU. And I expect that we will see the government position in the House of Commons shifting to that.
The Brexiteers have been literally counting how many times she has said that we will leave the EU on March the 29th.
She has, sir, said 108 times that we will leave the European Union on the 29th of March.
If we end up with an extension, they are going to be furious, aren't they?
I think they will be visibly furious. And I think they will make a huge, huge fuss about it.
If it's being delayed, which is my suspicion, as a plot to stop Brexit altogether, then I think that would be the most grievous error that politicians could commit. It would be overthrown.
But I think if she goes to the EU and asks for a three-month extension, I think they will still think a harder Brexit is to play for in that three-month extension. So absolutely, they won't. They certainly won't be voting for an extension. But I think they will actually see it as a kind of opportunity to keep playing for the harder Brexit that they want.
You're predicting that she's going to lose the vote. We know there's a majority in Parliament against no deal. Is it certain that MPs will also vote to extend Article 50?
It's really hard to say. I think we're in completely uncharted territory here. On the one hand, it's just logic, right? You voted against the Prime Minister's deal. You voted to take no deal off the table. There are literally 2 weeks left. I mean, what else are you going to do apart from vote to ask the Prime Minister to ask for a delay? So on one hand, logically, it kind of has to go through. The thing that makes me think, well, maybe there is a slight chance it doesn't, is I do think that some MPs will be really worried about going to their constituents and saying, well, look, I did vote for a three-month extension. And so I think you'll get some MPs who want to vote against that delay, hope the delay goes through, but they want to vote against it so that they can say to their constituents, well, look, I didn't vote for it. It was other MPs who did it. And if you've got enough MPs doing that, I mean, I suppose there's a chance that it doesn't pass. But I do think that if the Prime Minister sort of makes it official government policy, then it will pass.
If MPs reject Theresa May's deal, and then MPs say they want no deal off the table, kind of regardless of whether they vote for an extension or not, the next step in this, surely, and it's an urgent step, even with three extra months, is to find some sort of Brexit deal that could pass through Parliament. And in that scenario, the role of Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, becomes really, really important.
If it somehow does pass in some form at a later stage, we believe there must be a confirmatory public vote to see if people feel that's what they voted for.
So I just want to ask you how significant it is that Labour is now saying it will back a second referendum amendment in order to stop a Tory Brexit.
It's really hard when you look at Parliament to see where the numbers come from a second referendum. I think the only way Parliament will pass a second referendum is literally if it's last ditch, end of the road, doesn't look like Theresa May's deal's got a chance of going through. But I think her deal is more likely to go through. I think the way it will go through actually won't be through some kind of cross-party coalition. I think it will be through getting the bulk of the Tory party, possibly the DUP as well, behind her deal, with a few Labour MPs peeling away. So I think you may well at that point see Labour's official position being much more strongly, yes, we are in favour of a second referendum, but kind of knowing that it's not going to pass Parliament.
It's interesting you say that, because there is a possibility that Parliament could both reject a second referendum and reject Theresa May's deal right up to the wire. In that circumstance, there's quite a lot of work going on behind the scenes to try and find a cross-party consensus. And the only thing that there really is a majority for in Parliament potentially in that situation is a softer form of Brexit. We know that Labour MPs Lucy Powell, Stephen Kinnock have been working across the floor with Tory MPs like Robert Halfen, Nick Bowles, Oliver Letwin on what they call Common Market 2.0. That's essentially keeping us within the single market. Jeremy Corbyn met them last week to discuss that scenario. Could Labour be moving towards swinging behind a softer Brexit?
I think if we didn't have this sequencing issue, right, where we sort of leave the European Union and then we start the conversations about what a future relationship looks like, if we were doing everything at the same time, I think you could see how a cross-party coalition might come together in favour of a very soft Brexit. The problem is that we're signed up to a sequencing whereby we leave. True, we've got this kind of political declaration that sets out some nice mood music about what that future trading relationship would look like, but it's not binding on anyone. Those discussions are all to come. And Our parliamentary system is not set up for a cross-party coalition to hold together over the, you know, 2-3 years it might take to negotiate a soft Brexit option, a Norway plus option. I mean, that in of itself is going to take time. And it's just really hard to see how our system could support it.
So loads going on this week, hugely critical week in Parliament. But on Friday, which will be exactly 2 weeks until we are supposed to leave the EU.
Ah!
We could just be as confused as ever, couldn't we?
Yeah, I think we'll get a little bit more direction by then on a delay. So I expect in 2 weeks' time, I expect Theresa May will have asked the EU for an extension and we will have got some sort of answer. But I think all the same question marks will be hanging over Brexit. We won't know what sort of deal we're going for. All we'll know is that we've got probably an extra 3 months, maybe a bit longer.
So no holidays in June?
No.
The sticking point with Brussels has centred entirely around the backstop, which we know is an insurance policy to guarantee a soft border in Ireland.
Our backstop in this document provides answer to each of these questions.
It says that if no alternative is found, Northern Ireland would stay in parts of the single market and the whole of the UK in a customs union.
Our backstop cannot be extended to the whole UK.
That has upset the Democratic Unionist Party.
And the policy must be to get rid of the current backstop. And to look for an alternative way to deal with the fact that we shouldn't have a hard border on the island of Ireland.
Who said it would break the UK up, and it sent Tory Brexiteers into a spin, as they argued we'd be trapped in a customs union forever.
The whole thing is rancid. So you could change one little bit here or one little bit there. We're still never going to vote for it.
Dan, Theresa May sent her Attorney General, the blustering former barrister Geoffrey Cox, to Brussels.
What are you doing? You are not children.
To try and persuade negotiators to give Britain a way out of the backstop in the future. What do they make of him?
So there's no doubting his intellectual grasp. They do doubt his grasp of EU law. They've never met him before. He's been here 3 times and they feel that he's been quite patronising and they feel they've had to explain to him what's been going on the last 2 years.
Where's Stephen Barclay, the Brexit secretary?
When asked what he gets up to, they said, well, he kind of introduces the meeting and then at the end sort of summarise it a bit.
He's taking the minutes.
Taking the minutes. Although, actually, a lot of them say, actually, of the three Brexit secretaries, he's been sort of the better of the three.
What didn't they like about David Davis and Dominic Raab?
Actually, they quite liked David Davis. He liked his breezy way about him. He's a nice enough chap, but he'd stopped coming. So you know, it wasn't that they didn't dislike him, he just wasn't here. And then Dominic Raab, you know, full of vim and vigour, as he famously said on his first day.
Looking forward to with renewed energy, vigour and vim, looking at the detail of all of this.
They just thought he was a complete waste of time.
The way the union makes its decisions tends to be at 59th minute of the 11th hour of the 11th day and so on.
David Davis often says, right. A lot of people often say, the EU always take negotiating down to the wire. It's always at the 11th hour that a deal is done. Is that true?
It's certainly true that is the EU style in a normal negotiation with a member state. For example, in the Greek crisis, you know, it went to the 11th hour, 12th hour, and then stop the clock and do some more. This is a negotiation with very different interests as well. The EU is not there to make Brexit a success. The EU there is to try and limit the damage to themselves from Brexit. And throwing Ireland under the bus at the end would be horrendous for the EU. It would lose the faith of the Irish, but it would make all those smaller member states really question the solidarity when this is Brexit being the one policy area where the EU has been unified and together. And if it right at the last, the Franco-German axis said, oh, well, look, it's more important that we keep close economic relationship with the UK than please Ireland. What a disaster. They've slightly boxed themselves in by being so ever so unified on this because they can't break it now. They really can't.
So it sounds like you think things are looking really bad and we are very close to the deadline. But if the EU is acting in its own economic interest, it doesn't want a no-deal scenario. So would they countenance an extension?
An extension, yes. There are talks today about what's going to happen if the UK asks for an extension. But all the leaders, like Macron, Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, has said it, and Pedro Sanchez, the prime minister of Spain, has said it. They say it has to be an extension with a purpose. You can't just be an extension for no particular reason. That just sort of delays the inevitable. And there's no point. Businesses have already planned for the possibility of a no-deal Brexit on 29th of March. In reality, I can't see any of the member states saying no to putting off a no-deal Brexit, even if there's no real particular purpose. So I can imagine that whatever happens, we are not going to leave on the 29th of March, because I think they will try and kick the can down the road for a couple of months, and in the hope that something else happens to stop a no-deal Brexit, you know, maybe a general election in the UK or whatever. So I think it will happen. It needs unanimity. So all the 27 leaders have to agree for there to be an extension. And the closer we get to 29th March, the less time you can rectify a mistake.
Dan, thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
You can stay across everything that is happening with Brexit this week in Westminster and Brussels, and with comment from our columnists on Andrew Sparrow's Political Live blog. Coming up, is there anything you can do to reduce the harm caused by air pollution? Welcome back. Now, environment correspondent Matthew Taylor on the practical steps you can take to help limit the negative effects of air pollution.
Air pollution is definitely something you should be concerned about. We've seen a slew of recent studies that show increasing health effects, from heart disease to record levels of deaths from asthma to dementia to, there was a study just last week or the last couple of weeks about the impact of air pollution on teenage depression. So these are really serious health issues which we're starting to realise are associated with air pollution. But there are things you can do to minimise your exposure to air pollution. So the first place you can start to make a difference in air quality is in your own home. Plants in the home definitely do make a difference to air quality. Not as much as other things, but they do reduce air quality. They take some particulates out of the atmosphere. I mean, you need upwards of 4, 5, 6 plants in each room for it to start making a difference. But of course, having plants in your house is a good thing anyway. It reduces stress, increases people's feeling of well-being, and all sorts of studies show that. So that's just a good starting point generally, I think. Above and beyond that, you can buy air filters, air purifiers, but you need to be careful about which ones you buy and do the research to make sure that the ones you're buying actually work. If you get good quality ones, they can set you back a lot of money. They can be up to £1,000, but they do remove up to 95-99% of particulate pollutions, gas pollutions, so they are really very effective. Once we leave the home, then the other area we're exposed to air pollution is when we're in transit around cities and built up urban areas. And there are things you can do to address that. If you can avoid busy roads to walk or cycle on, that can make a huge difference. I mean, I think 50 to 100 metres from a busy road can reduce the exposure to air pollution by between a third and a half. And obviously the same when you're choosing which house to buy or live in, or which school to send your children to. All those sort of factors should be involved. In terms of the masks that you see some people wear, I think there's a degree of scepticism about how effective they are. I think that if you get top-end masks and they're correctly fitted and 100% sealed to your face and have the correct filters in, they can make a difference. But most masks that you see and are loosely fitted over people's faces are not going to make a huge amount of difference. Another thing to bear in mind is to check the air quality on the underground systems that you're using. I know here in London that the air pollution levels on the tube network can be unpleasantly dirty, up to 10 times that on the dirtiest roads. So it is always worth becoming informed about what the state of air pollution is on the underground networks you're using. Ultimately, these are all really useful tools to try and minimise your exposure to air pollution. But in the end, we really need to look at collective action to address this issue. I think that the most important thing is to become informed, as I've said, but once you're informed, is to push for systematic change in the way our transport systems are organised, the way we run our cities, the way we move around our cities, the way our heating systems work. And that is a systemic thing, and I think we have to push back systemically on these things, as well as trying to take individual measures to minimise what we're doing. I do think that people need to think carefully about using their cars and when they use their cars in built-up areas and in urban areas. I think we're fast coming to a time when driving around in cities in cars will become a sort of socially unacceptable. When that does happen, that will make a big difference to air quality.
That was Matthew Taylor. My thanks to him and to Daniel Boffey and Sonia Soda. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys, Miles Martignoni and Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you tomorrow.